This episode is brought to you by ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. Enter ServiceNow. It puts AI to work for people, for employees, for developers, and even your customers, removing frustration and supercharging productivity. On our intelligent platform, AI isn't just a promise. It's happening today. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. To learn more, visit servicenow.com/AI for people.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson. Hey, Jay.
Good morning, Mike. Hey.
How are you doing today?
I'm okay. Well, geez, I wasn't expecting that.
You know,
so I usually was going to prepare something, but
you're doing fine.
No, happy to be here.
I'm glad to have you. You know, we haven't done listener mail in a little while, and so I thought we had a bunch of things, and I thought we would just kind of get right at it if you're ready.
How about this? I expect that after the listener mail section, I'll sort of feel like I say I blew it. Never mind. Pittsburgh quarterback on Friday morning.
Oh, there you go. I like it. Okay. Anyway. Yeah. Oh, my head. Okay. Let's start with Francis, who's not only a listener, but actually a fellow political scientist. Wrote in to let us know that a few weeks ago when we discussed Social Security, we weren't entirely accurate. He writes, It was said that the program, Social Security, has never been solvent. That's not true at all. In fact, it has run very large surpluses for many decades. Only very recently has it hit the tipping point where revenues are about the same as spending, with the trend towards spending exceeding revenues. However, those decades of surpluses were borrowed by the federal government from the Social Security Administration to spend on other priorities. The borrowed money, however, must be paid back by the feds in each year that expenses exceed revenue, so that is starting to happen. This has been painful for the feds, no more free Social Security money, and they now have to start making good on those IOUs. The huge amount of IOUs that must be paid back will keep Social Security solvent for a few more decades, but there will come a time when indeed Social Security is no longer profitable. That will force us to make even harder choices. So, Jay, when I read this, I thought immediately of one word. This will take us back quite a few years, but that one word is lockbox, and I think you'll know
lockbox.
What I mean, right?
Yes, absolutely. No, well, he's exactly right. I think we should point out I wasn't on the show when that
right.
The statement was made. But yeah, it's although it's a little bit of a technical accounting thing, the money still hasn't really been there. It's been elsewhere. And lockbox was, of course, the famous phrase that Al Gore used in the first debate about how he would handle Social Security. And he said he would put it in a lockbox, and no one really understood what he was talking about.
Yeah, like there was this big, people were envisioning this big Scrooge McDuck vault or
exactly.
Something like that with the relabeled Social Security money. And of course, that's, you know, one of the weird things, and I think it's hard for a lot of people to wrap their heads around this, is when you're talking about budgeting on a national government level, especially United States government, because of the unique position that the dollar has. It's a very different thing from a household budget. When people try to make those analogies between a household budget or a business budget, once you start pushing them, they really start to fall apart because, of course, the government can borrow from itself, which sounds like a weird sort of a thing. And a lot of the money that the federal government owes, it owes to itself. And that, and when you start getting into that, it's hard to kind of understand that from the perspective that most people have, and that's kind of like your household budget perspective, right? And of course, but as Francis points out, eventually, no matter who you borrow the money from, whether it's, you know, part of our national debt is money we borrow from our own citizens, part of it's from other parts of the government, part of it's from other, you know, foreign governments. And Japan, it's number one, and China right behind there in terms of what, you know, treasury bills that they hold. Eventually, not only does it have to be paid back, even if it's rolled over, you still have to pay interest on that. And
right.
as that becomes bigger and bigger, that starts to eat into, you know, the percentage of interest even you're paying just to service those debts starts to really eat into what you can do. And I think that's a point that a lot of conservatives, you know, have concern about.
Right. And well, I think the point that you can, the government can borrow from itself, and I think you sort of and highlighted, but only for a while.
Yeah.
Eventually, it's going to catch up. And there is also, there's a cost, the government continually borrowing
sure.
from itself. And that cost usually ends up in the form of higher interest rates
yeah.
Down the road. But I mean, I guess the better way to analogize this to like a household budget, it's almost like, say you get a home equity loan or something like that, where you borrow money out of your house and then you pay it back. And the idea is that your home continues to appreciate in value and also that you don't borrow more than the equity that's already in,
right,
your, in
yeah.
your home. And that's Social Security. It's sort of like, it's almost like 100% home equity loan that this was all sort of borrowed and now does have to be paid back. There's various budget ways for the government to kick the can down the road. But eventually there's going to be a reckoning, either in terms of a drag on the economy, lower benefits, what have you, but you know, like I've said before, at the end of the day, gravity always wins.
Yeah,
so
it's hard. I mean, it keeps on getting pushed further down the road. And we're, I think, regularly surprised. A lot of people are regularly surprised that the fact that interest rates are so low. In fact, you know, below 2%, below actually where the Fed would want them to be.
Right.
And so this seems to be like we're defying gravity a little bit. But as I think you and I both agree, that eventually, as you put it, gravity will win no matter how much we borrow. And at some point, the rest of the world is going to refuse to give us those low rates. And you can only print so much money before that runs into the same problems. But whether that's going to be a problem in 10 years or 20 years, you know, obviously nobody knows.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This next question, I think you're really going to like, Jay, because it's come up in the past. Yuri writes, I found you through the Politics Guys website. Now, pardon me for this random question, and I may not be familiar enough with how elections work in the United States, but as a strategy, wouldn't it make sense for some Trump supporters to register Democrat for the primaries and vote for the weakest candidate they can get selected? And Jay, go ahead and take this one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That happens. That happens a lot. Does it really work as a strategy? I don't know. In my experience, it tends not to. Just because there are typically not enough of supporters who are going to cross that line and register it to the other party to vote in the primary. And that there's not enough of a difference a lot of times in the candidates. I mean, unless you have one that is, you know, extremely stronger or weaker to make that much of a difference, you know. And if you do have that situation, right, where you have two candidates in a primary and one is extremely strong and one is extremely weak, that's going to show in the you know, primary results from that party, and just jumping in to vote for the weak guy isn't usually going to be enough to change things. As a participant in American politics, it often frustrates me because it screws everything up for the voter rolls and the people and who you mail stuff to on the next election cycle. I know we certainly had here in Ohio and here where I live, a lot of Democrats who jumped into the Ohio presidential primary in 2016 just to vote against Trump. And now they're frustrated because they've put themselves on the Republican Party mailing list and they're getting offers for getting their MAGA hats and stuff. And there's always this, how did I get on this list? Well, it's by you know, changing your party affiliation. So can it happen? Yes. Does it happen? Yes. As far as is effective, in my experience, no, especially at a bigger presidential election.
Yeah.
If you have something small and there's, you know, local stuff and you can, you know, maybe you can move the needle there. But I think in a nationwide or statewide election, it's not going to make a difference.
Yeah. And that's pretty much the political science answer as well. People who've researched this basically find that, number one, most people just aren't that strategic. And number two, most people just aren't even interested in primaries. It's hard enough to get people to even vote in a primary, not to mention to figure out how to change their party registration and then vote in the other party. That's just, as you point out, Jay, especially when you get up to the higher levels and presidential level, that even if it does happen occasionally, and it does, it's just not nearly enough to move the needle there. So yep. In theory, it also would create just incredible coordination problems. So just for a lot of reasons, while theoretically it absolutely could work, in the real world at higher levels, it's just not really a factor.
And there's also, it also, I would say, varies from state to state, because different states have different rules about eligibility for primaries and so forth.
Good point.
For example, where we live, in Ohio, you can pretty much just show up the day of the election and they ask you which ballot you want, and you tell them, and that's essentially your party registration.
Yeah.
Other states have more hoops you have to jump through as far as when and how you change your registration.
Right. Yeah, good point. Okay, next up we have Raph, who writes, I hear from the Trump camp the argument that what Hunter Biden did is terrible, corrupt, and potentially illegal. But what's the difference from what Hunter Biden has done and what Cohen did when he sold his services to companies as a consultant? I seem to remember that everyone in the Trump camp thought that this was totally acceptable, normal, and that everybody does it. Is this just hypocrisy, or is there an actual legal difference? Thank you. I love the show. Well, Jay, it's about a legal difference.
That's a good question.
I'll toss that to you first.
Well, I think, is there a legal difference? No, not necessarily. What the difference to me would be, is that in this case you had, the Joe Biden essentially being the, grand poobah, the, I don't know what, sort of administrator of all things Ukraine, in the, Obama administration. And one of the big concerns was, corruption. And then you sort of have, Hunter Biden just stepping in as, sort of insulation against that corruption, at least for Burisma, right? The difference between someone who is friends of a president, close to a president, then selling their services as a consultant, that happens all the time. I think the difference is, this goes to some lobbying laws. One is that, you know, being able to promise to affect a regulatory outcome and so forth is typically prohibited in a lot of lobbying contracts. Again, that varies from state to state. But my sense is, look, if you want to hire somebody as a consultant because, hey, this the president's an old friend of mine and, you know, I can help make the case and he'd be happy to hear from me and I can go make the case for you. That's one thing. It's something else to sort of hire the police chief's son. In the hope that you're going to avoid prosecution. Now, from a legal standpoint, I don't know that there is a whole lot of difference, because while the Biden situation, had it been the other way around, for example, a foreign company paying, a U.S. company paying the son of a foreign vice president, it would be illegal. But it's not, because it's a Ukrainian law, situation. So no, I'm not saying the two aren't dissimilar. I guess it's more, what are the expectations, for why that person is being hired?
Yeah.
That makes it look bad or worse. Yeah.
And it still could
be Hunter Biden. They're just trying to curry favor. But it's tougher when they're trying to curry favor with the guy who is the not even so much the regulator, but almost law enforcement, And I suppose there's a fine line between those two, but you get what I mean.
Sure. And of course, yeah. And of course, to point out that nobody is actually alleging, or no one has actually said that there's anything specifically illegal they can point to that Hunter Biden has done. It's just, well, this seems fishy and look through. And Jay, you and I have talked about this in terms of what we call soft corruption, which basically means things that aren't illegal, but just don't smell right. And I think we both agree that this falls into that. Now, it crosses the line into actual corruption or illegality when somebody breaks a law of whether it's the United States or the Ukraine or what have you. And now, you know, in the Cohen case, when there are actual violations of law, well, that's a different sort of thing, certainly. And so while everyone engages in soft corruption to a certain extent, trying to curry favor by hiring connected people, and sometimes that's not really rise to the level of soft corruption, other times it does, it's not okay to actually break the law, basically. And that, to me, is the actual legal difference. And I think you and I probably agree pretty closely on that one.
Right. And I'll point out, this is a purely hypothetical situation, Mike. I'm not saying this happened or didn't happen, but purely hypothetical. Uh-huh. Supposing there was evidence, and I'm not saying there is, that Joe Biden did something in order to, in exchange, or did something or refused to do something in exchange for understanding that his son would accept a whole lot of money for
doing
nothing.
Corruption. Hard corruption.
That would be corruption. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Totally agree. All right. Let's see here. Zach writes, more often than not, and especially in President Trump's current cabinet of secretaries, the people that are filling these massively important positions are professional politicians, non-experts, and people who are owed a favor by someone. If and when America has a Democrat in the office of the president, does that person need to fill their cabinet with industry experts to add credibility to their administration? And can and that can speak proficiently as experts in their fields? And I think this is an interesting question because it highlights a tension in upper-level administrative appointments. And I talk about this a lot in my classes. Of course, everyone wants the best people in these jobs, right? Regardless of what they are. But when you're looking at who is, say, best equipped to understand what goes into running, I don't know, the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Right.
Well, it's probably going to be somebody with a lot of background in the financial industry, which means it's going to be someone with a lot of financial industry ties. And so it's oftentimes extremely difficult to sort of separate the, well, I need somebody with the inside industry experience, but I also want somebody who isn't a creature of that industry. So basically our regulatory agency or our agency will be captured by that industry. And it can be a really fine line to walk. Now, I think typically Republican presidents who are less in favor of regulations tend to be more comfortable with hiring people from inside industry positions because they tend to be more anti-regulation or for loosening regulations, where under a Democratic president, that gets opened up maybe more to people who are from various interest groups who have a position in this, but don't necessarily have those inside ties to industry as much because they're kind of fighting against a lot of what they see as overreach by industry and are fighting for more regulation.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. I'd also add, a lot of times what you're looking for in a cabinet secretary is not necessarily the same skills that you're looking for in whatever that agency does. For example, would it be wise to appoint someone with a PhD in some sort of scientific field to the EPA as to be secretary ahead of it? Maybe, but consider that that person's job is not necessarily testing water samples or something like that. It's communicating to the public. It's being the public face of the organization. It's managing the organization. And those are sort of different responsibilities than the day-to-day field workers do.
Yeah. And so then like the people one level under that person, maybe you can make a much better case that they need to have more of the technical. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So in a lot of cases, you know, the person who has those sort of communication skills, the being the face of the organization, the political skills to manage the organization in Washington are politicians.
And you know, Jay, just more generally on this point, God, I would hate to be a cabinet. What an awful job to take when you think about, because people say, well, they make a lot of money and it's very prominent. But I think, you know, most anyone who is remotely qualified to run one of these massive,
more money elsewhere, yeah,
a lot more money elsewhere, right? And not only that, but the scrutiny of the confirmation hearings and the media attention and the fact that, you know, you serve at the pleasure of the president and you're not your own boss. You add all that stuff up together, and I can see why a lot of really good people would just pass on this, basically, because it's you know, it's just kind of seems to me kind of a miserable job. And I admire the people who take a pretty big hit to take it. Now, of course, there are some people who use advantage to the kind of revolving door thing, and then they use those contacts when they get out. But wow, it's not nearly as good of a job, I think, as a lot of people think it is.
Yeah, no, I'd agree.
All right, moving on. Peter writes, there seem to be many self-proclaimed fiscal conservatives on the podcast who seem far too eager to vote for far from fiscally conservative Trump. What are the predictions of everyone for how the Republican Party will bounce back after Trump? It seems to me voting Trump is securing the removal of fiscal conservatism from Republican values. I agree with
that's a good
pretty
point.
Much, yeah, but Jay, you are a Republican here today. So what do you think?
I am a Republican. I am a fiscal conservative, and I would agree with you 100%. And I think fiscal conservatives sounded that same alarm over George W. Bush this guy is, you know, I think he famously said something, when there's a problem, the government needs to act. And people are like, ah, and he passing, you know, No Child Left Behind. And yeah, spending really ballooned under him, and Trump likewise has not shown a whole lot of restraint. The response is the real politic answer is, it could be worse, and he's the lesser of two evils, and Trump may not be as fiscally responsible as one would like. But can you imagine an Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders? And I think that's sort of the, you know, often we're not left with the choices we want. And I think I've said before, there were probably about 17 other Republican candidates who I would have preferred to Donald Trump, mm-hmm. Partly because of that. No, I mean, you're exactly right. And I would hope that the Republican Party would get back to more fiscal conservatism and pushing that issue. The only problem is that's not a winning issue.
No, it never has been.
It never has been. And it's one of these, you know, we think we should spend less, and it opens up the attack of you're going to push the old ladies off the cliff and so forth. And you're cutting funding to the poor and even our military is, you know, not able to keep up and so forth. It's a really tough issue to win on.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm a former Republican fiscal conservative. I'm still a fiscal conservative, though I am more in favor of raising taxes to make sure we pay for things as opposed to borrowing. And you would be more kind of the Paul Ryan-ish sort of, well, let's just not spend more. And
yes.
Yeah, exactly. So
starve the beast.
That way we don't have to borrow, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Perry from all the way from Canberra, Australia, writes,
wow.
Yeah, Australia actually is one of our, I think, top five countries. And so, hey, from way over there. Anyway, he writes, if, as seems possible, Mike Pence is implicated in Donald Trump's efforts to get foreign assistance through the pressure for an investigation by Ukraine of the Bidens, could Pence also be open to impeachment and removal? If so, would Nancy Pelosi become president? And would this be the Republicans' worst nightmare? Jay, I'm sure it would be right up there with one of your worst nightmares, right?
Yeah. Is it theoretically possible? Yes. Is it probable? No. I think it's that would be a really, a real stretch. And I think there would be a real big pushback in the American electorate.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think it's one thing to a lot of people even Republicans who are sort of suffering from Trump fatigue and like, oh my God, I can't believe this idiot did this. But who would see the like a double removal as something, you know, more akin to a coup?
And just right? just politically, that would be a disaster for the Democrats. Yeah. So even though theoretically, and it seems to me that Pence really hasn't come up a whole lot in that. And even if he had, I think Democrats probably would have just stayed away from it for exactly that political reason, because it would have just seemed that would have really quit the legitimacy.
It would very much look like overreach. Yeah,
absolutely. All right. Amy left a comment on our website recently, and it was a really interesting extended comment. I've edited down just a little bit. She writes, "I'm a real estate and title insurance attorney and have been so for 25 years. I was discouraged to hear one of the commentators literally blame the recession on George W. Bush for not properly regulating Wall Street. It was my understanding that relaxed regulation of Wall Street actually began in Clinton's years. The fact that pretty much no one suffered any significant repercussions for the morally corrupt lending during those years, which would have fallen during Obama's administration, had led right back to the very similar lending practices as existed pre-recession. I see the recession is not a Republican-Democrat battle. It is a greed battle in that all of these wealthy presidents and the wealth of Capitol Hill is playing nicey-nice with Wall Street and have lost all touch with the average American. I will add that there are literally thousands of title employees and escrow closers in this country with no more than a high school diploma who knew we were headed for a recession years and years before it happened." Well, I would say absolutely, Amy. I mean, this definitely is a bipartisan thing. You know, this is the case where Bernie Sanders, I believe, is maybe goes a little overboard in stating this. Maybe it's for rhetorical effect, saying that, you know, Congress is basically, or DC is basically owned by Wall Street. I wouldn't say that, but they definitely have some strong rental rights on a lot of DC. And, you know, that's where the money is. You take a look at where the campaign contributions for that come from. The main source is that insurance and financial industries, basically, and that they get to have a pretty outsized say in these things. I mean, our system is designed to reward people who are organized and put a lot of money into the system. And so that's what we're seeing in both Democrats and Republicans. I mean, we started to see loosening of regulations in the Reagan years, and that was continued right on through every single other presidency in both Democrat and Republican administrations and Congresses, because, hey, it seemed to be, everything seemed to be going more or less okay. And even if people at the grassroots didn't think it was, well, a lot of people had a pretty big financial stake in both sides of the aisle and closing their eyes and just saying, no, I'm sure it'll be fine. So that's my take. I agree pretty much wholeheartedly with Amy there. What do you say, Jay?
Well, I'd say she's not wrong. And neither are you entirely, but,
okay.
I think there was another factor if we're talking specifically about the mortgage crisis, and that is the role that the federal government played in, you know, shoring up institutions like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that sort of began the practice of making these loans and these risky loans, and then sort of forced the market into competing with them, sort of a race to the bottom there. That's not excusing Wall Street or saying there shouldn't have been more regulation in terms of what's done. And again, to me, it seems it's less a Wall Street issue and more a banking issue, right? Wall Street was trading these securities,
sure,
of you sort of divvied up mortgage pieces, but it's more the issue of the banks that were making these bad loans, yeah, that then undercut them. So I wouldn't blame Wall Street entirely. To some extent, Wall Street was providing the capital to keep the thing afloat for a while, despite these bad loans, which people knew at the time were likely bad loans. So
they were bad loans, but they were told by the geniuses, literally in some cases, the geniuses at Wall Street, that they had found a way to securitize these things and to combine them in certain incredibly esoteric ways that
the idea would be there would be enough good loans in the package to make up for the bad ones.
Yeah. And basically you could have increased returns without increased risk. And that's what many of these geniuses were saying. And of course, that sounds ridiculous on the face of it, but there was a lot of money in believing that that would be the case. And Jay, of course, while you're right in saying that, I think some on the left tend to de-emphasize too much the role that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac played. I think a lot of people on the right tend to overemphasize their role in the entirety of this, and that's not terrifically surprising, I would say. Okay, we have Dusty, who has a question, I guess, for me. He says, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on something that occurred to me recently. Given your background of leaving conservatism for a more progressive outlook on life, what do you see as some possible benefits of Senator Warren's background as a one-time conservative, both as a candidate as well as a possible president? As a candidate, it seems she would be adept at the ideological Turing test, for one, which would enable her to spar with a normal conservative candidate exceptionally well. As a leader, she may be more pragmatic rather than dogmatic, which I tend to prefer. Well, you know, I think I'd like to think, Dusty, that applies to me, maybe more than Elizabeth Warren, certainly.
You're no Elizabeth Warren.
I'm no Elizabeth Warren, no. But, you know, that raises some interesting points, because as a lot of people may or may not know, I don't know that for quite a lot of her life, Elizabeth Warren was identified more in a much more conservative way than she does now. And I guess I think certainly it is a benefit in that, having lived in that world, she probably has a better feel for some of those arguments and viewpoints than someone who's always been in their own bubble. But in terms of how that might be a benefit in any other way, I don't think really so much, just basically because I don't necessarily feel that it would make her more pragmatic. It seems to me that she has sort of aligned herself with a series of very progressive political views, and maybe she is playing three-dimensional chess here, or at least looking two moves ahead and saying that I'm staking out these positions in large part because I believe it best positions me to win the primary. And I think I can tack enough back to center to win the general election. And then, given my understanding and my innate pragmaticism, I will be able to broker some deals and so forth. Maybe that's true. But in her entire political career as an active politician, I've seen no evidence of her doing that. Now, I wouldn't necessarily have seen any evidence that she's basically setting all this up for a presidential run when she would do this. But to me, based on the evidence that we have, I would say that feels somewhat unlikely to me, I guess. Jay, what do you think?
To me, it strikes me a little bit. It's like arguing that Darth Vader is a much better Sith Lord and would be better running the Empire because he used to be a Jedi. And I think you sort of that encapsulates the thing of once you turn to the dark side, you're gone. And I think if she ever was conservative, I don't think she certainly isn't now, and I don't think really has any credibility to bring in conservatives other even, you know, moderates or something like that, based on, well, I used to think this, or I can anticipate these arguments, because her, from what I've seen, there isn't much, I mean, different new nuance kind of stuff. It's sort of the standard left stuff. Now it's longer, you know what I mean? And sort of the plans and so forth, but I don't see any difference in kind.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I think
she's just like a more comprehensive version of Bernie Sanders.
Right. Well, I think, you know, you have two types of sort of political conversion experiences, if you will. There's the kind of road to Damascus, you know, kind of all of a sudden I become this zealot for the other side. I have seen the light, sort of thing. And then there are people, I think, who I myself in this latter category, who sort of just end up finding himself somehow over on the other side of the line, no dramatic anything. And
join the team that you're on.
You know, yeah, it just kind of happened. Yeah. And I can still see a lot from both, you know, from both sides. And that, I would say, is a very, it's a conversion, certainly, because I'm unquestionably a person of the left now, but you know, I don't think that I'm a zealot in any way, shape, or form. But maybe that's just because even though I moved to the left, I never became a non-Burkean, I guess, and that probably limits me a lot in terms of how zealous I will be, I would suppose. So anyway, let's do one more question, Jay, from Zach, who says, you know, I'm a well-informed voter, but also as a millennial, I found that while I'm hopeful for the future, thinking about gun reform, when I think about the immediate climate crisis, voter reform, the national debt and student debt, I also have this feeling of hopelessness because it feels like nothing is ever going to change. I'm getting married next year, and we hope to begin a family soon after, but I fear for the life of my family if they grow up in a world where change is impossible because of the gridlock in Washington. I'm a believer that my vote matters in each election, but what would you say to the millennials and Gen Xers who think nothing will ever change? And Jay, I got to say, this is a question that resonates with me because I get this question all the time because I teach, you know, millennials and Gen Xers. And we were just finishing up a book and they said to me, you know, you always give us these books to read. And then at the end, the author talks about these solutions and then you tell us why they can't happen. And it's just depressing. I get it, you know, and it certainly is. And I sometimes struggle to find an answer to a lot of these. And I guess I put a lot of faith in incrementalism. I tend to think that a lot of these challenges that we face over the course of 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and this is maybe one of the advantages, Jay, I don't know, there aren't too many of them, of being a little bit older, is you can sort of see that arc of progress and addressing a lot of these things, you know, like LGBTQ rights, like minority rights, like a lot of things, where when you and I were growing up, there were things that were not even considered to be, you know, part of the political discussion. They were too right outside of the realm, but now they're very mainstream and they're just kind of like how things are. And so seeing that gives me hope. But then again, there are other issues that we haven't changed a lot on. And Zach, you know, you mentioned a lot of them, certainly. I see particularly the climate issue. I'm a lot less sanguine about it than, say, someone like Jay is. But overall, I think, and maybe this is just me coming to terms with my hopelessness, I don't know, but I think that for the most part, the system is not nearly as broken as a lot of people, especially a lot of people in the media, think. And that while we focus on the gridlock, when push comes to shove and given a long enough timeline, we've managed to solve almost all of these problems, or a lot of these problems, or make them better, at least, if not solve them. And while we still could come up on a problem that's insoluble, at least in our current political alignment and our current institutional setup, I mean, every other system has fallen, right? So it would be kind of hubris to think that ours won't. So far, I think we have a fairly decent track record. So I am extremely cautiously, slightly optimistic, I guess I would say. And that's what I would tell people. It's maybe not very inspiring. It's not inspiring at all, hell, but that's what I tell people. Jay?
I would say a slightly different message. I'm optimistic, but maybe for different reasons. And Mike and I are both Gen Xers, obviously. And I want to point out that when we were in high school, the big political concern that sort of kept me up at night was nuclear annihilation.
Uh-huh, yeah, there you go.
I mean, literally, there was a belief that we might be the very last generation of human beings, that nuclear war would wipe out everything, that we would be living in sort of a Mad Max kind of future, if at all.
Sting wrote songs about it.
Yeah, hope the Russians love their children too.
Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly. 99 red balloons and you name it. I mean, this was a big deal. And it's hard for people to really grasp that. Yeah, but
exactly.
We were concerned deeply.
And the day after and all this. So yeah, to me, that was, and quite honestly, that's something that kind of propelled me into politics and public policy. Because like, oh my God, this is,
if
this isn't handled right, the world could end. And it didn't. It turned out okay, which is good. The other things, I mean, we heard growing up in the 70s and the 80s are, one, there was concern about the coming ice age in the 70s. And I know there's some revisionist history in that, but I have a specific memory of even discussing this in school. And I had an idea about, you know, couldn't you send guys with flamethrowers just to kind of burn it back a couple inches every year? Cause it was only, but there were Paul Ehrlich, Mike, I'm sure you remember him.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He's
been predicting the end of the world, for a good 40 years now, always just over the horizon. But Ehrlich had been predicting mass famine, you know, starting in the 80s.
Population bomb, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, population bomb. And he keeps revising it. You know, then also there was the environmental destruction. If you go back and read Earth in the Balance, which I did way back in the day, there are all sorts of predictions there of horrible things that are going to come to pass. And one, again, this is one that strikes me, Mike, because it affected me, was Al Gore was predicting that the levels of the Great Lakes was going to decline so significantly. The Great Lakes would be drying up. And as you know, I'm a avid yachtsman.
Yachtsman, yes, exactly.
And I was concerned, thinking like, man, this is going to suck. By the time I can get my yacht, the lake's going to be so low, I won't really be able to
like a waiting to use pool. It. Yeah,
exactly. And of course, last year we had record high lake levels, which were, of course, attributed to the climate change that Gore was attributing that the drops were going to be to. Right. So my point is that most of the prophets of doom have been wrong.
But you're not saying that that's a reason to ignore warnings, right?
No. But I, okay, I'm saying
so people are going to say
keep,
that. I
keep in mind, if someone says the world's ending. There's usually also the next lines coming in and, you know, I'm the only one that can fix it. And sort of the line after that is, so you need to give me money, or support or something like that. So, I would say, yeah, treat the prophets of doom as such. And also I think we should rely on, human creativity and resilience in the market. And there are so many things. Again, now that we look at, there are diseases that we didn't think we can cure, and now we can. There's incredible technology that no one ever dreamed of that now we have. You know, so I think there's solutions, and the solutions aren't always what you predict them to be.
Sure. Right? Okay. So let me ask you this, Jay, and I try to share as much of that optimism as I can, because I think we should all hope that you're right about this, right? I'm not as optimistic, but I hope you're right. But let's move from a technological thing to more of a structural issue. And, you know, Zach mentions things like about the debt and that sort of thing. We talked about it earlier, is that, you know, it's tough politically to make a case to be fiscally conservative. And eventually, I know both you and I think that those chickens come home to roost.
Absolutely.
And if our debt becomes, say, 300% of our GDP, there's some level at which it's unsustainable. And given the political incentives to kick that particular can down the road, I think it's maybe more difficult to make an argument that human ingenuity is going to fix that structural problem. It's more likely, you might argue, if you're a pessimist, that no, we just actually need to change the political incentives and change that structure for that to change. And it doesn't matter what great things we invent. So there's maybe more cause for pessimism as to our political structure as opposed to our continued existence as a species on the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right. There's a couple of things I also point to is, our debt is to some extent always a function of demographics, and demographics will change. And we're going to go through a big balloon here before it does, but then it will change. Unless they scientifically figure out a way to keep the baby boomers alive indefinitely, which they may.
Yes, exactly.
I think that's a problem, but it's also one of these things of, We tend to react to problems when they finally reach the front burner, and it hasn't reached the front burner yet. Sooner or later it will, and there will be some pain in dealing with it, I think. But it's not something that can't be fixed.
Right. And the optimistic scenario is that we start to see a slow creep upward, and it's not like a fall off a cliff sort of thing. And so there are some problems, and this is the climate change thing comes in, where there are some folks who say, well, once you hit a certain tipping point, then that's it. And of course, if that's the case, and whether it's climate change or something else, that means you have a real problem. And that was certainly that way with nuclear war, because, you know, once the silos are open and the missiles are in the air,
tipping point, that's it. Yeah
basically. And so that's another question we have to answer. You know, we want to try to answer is this a tipping point type issue, or is this something that we can see it getting bad enough and arrest it? Now, on climate change, there are a lot of people on the left like myself who say, well, it seems to me more like a tipping point thing. And Jay, you and a lot of people on the right say, no, actually, there's time and we should put more faith in inventiveness, that sort of thing. Yeah. And so, yeah, absolutely.
Or even if not, to the extent we're going to suffer the consequences of climate change, we are better able to deal with them being wealthy than being not wealthy.
Right, right. All right, well, I think that does it for our questions this week. And so we, of course, before I go, I should say that if you haven't yet subscribed to the show, we would really appreciate it if you could do that. Real simple to do. And if you could also write reviews, positive ones, we hope, and let people know about the show, that would be great. If you want to get in touch with us, we're at mail@politicsguys.com. There's our Facebook page, where I got to say, Jay, lately, I feel like our policy to kind of cut out the memes and the kind of that's worked out really well. There's
a lot of good substantive discussion stuff now.
Absolutely. And that's facebook.com/politicsguyspage. And let's see, I think that's about it. But the executive producers, as you know, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, and Daniel Toe. Today's show is produced by me, Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with the new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us.